So you've told stories in the last two books of three different women.
Yeah, they're all very, very different women. My book for last was called The Spy Who Laughed, and it's a biography of Christina Scarbeck, a.k.a. Christine Granville, who was the first woman to work for Britain as a special agent in the Second World War. So Christina was a Polish countess and a great Polish patriot. And she wasn't actually in Poland when Nazi Germany invaded in September 1939. She was married to a diplomat and they were on their way to a posting in southern Africa. And when they heard the terrible news, they immediately tried to find out how they could best serve their country. And they decided to come back as quickly as they could. But by the time they got back to Europe, Poland had been occupied. Poland never capitulated. They had a government in exile, which originally went to France and then came to London. And so both she and her husband decided to volunteer and serve them. And it's a wonderful story, actually, because Christine came into Southampton and within a couple of days, she is banging on the door of the headquarters of the British Secret Services, which, of course, nobody's meant to know where that address is. So she obviously had her contacts. Yeah. And we can only imagine the look on the faces of the guys inside as this Polish patriot came in full of passion, determined to do her bit. Because first of all, to work for the British Secret Services, you have to be British. And she was Polish. Yeah. And then above all, she was female. And this was long before, almost 2 years before any other women were recruited. And yet she is so brilliant. She has the languages. She speaks French perfectly, pretty good English. She obviously speaks Polish. She speaks a bit of other languages as well. She has the contact. She's very well connected in Warsaw. She got people across Poland that she knows. She's got people over here and she's got the courage, but above all, she knows how to get in and out of Poland because when she was a rather bored Polish countess earlier, she used to smuggle cigarettes across the border over the High Tatra Mountains on her skis, not because she needed the money or anything. She just did it for kicks. So she knew the smuggling route. She knew the Goral people, the mountain people. And so she knew how to get in and out as well. And they had to use her. She actually worked in three different theatres of the war, but her first work was going across the mountains. She was based in Budapest with a British alibi and so on. And she took her first journey across that winter in conditions of minus 20 degrees, incredibly difficult, and made contact with the fledgling Polish resistance, which was just getting organised, and managed to bring back the first sort of idea of how troop movements were being organised in Poland, how the occupying forces were working. So really useful work. And that was just sort of the precursor of her work, really. She went on and served in Egypt and the Middle East, and then her most famous work, the work that made her legendary within the British Special Forces, was when she was parachuted behind enemy lines in occupied France in July 1944. So she wasn't just the first woman to work in that role. She was also the longest serving female special agent of the war. And although she was very highly honoured, her story was pretty much covered up after the war. And it was wonderful to be able to research it, interview people and bring that story back to us.
So you go from someone that we can obviously see as a heroine, but your next book, two very different women.
Yes. Well, there is a rich seam of women's stories which are yet to be told. And it's wonderful to write the story of a heroine. And it was absolutely fantastic and inspiring. And talking to these people, it was really exciting. And I felt it was a real honour as well as an adventure to write her story. But I don't want to just coast on the stories of these heroines. I wanted to do something. I wanted to understand more about the war. I decided to try and look at a story from the other side. So this is not to glorify in any sense. This is trying to work out how did Hitler manage to corral these different resources in his country to support his appalling ends. I'd heard a bit about Hannah Reich, who is the more famous of my two Nazi test pilots. She wrote her own story, had her memoirs published after the war. She actually had different versions of them done. And the little edits, the changes are quite interesting to look at. Anyhow, she re-spun her story. And her story's really been told on her terms. And so even recently, there have been a couple of biographies and they present her as being a brilliant pilot, which she absolutely was. Yeah. Amazing pilot. Very courageous. No question about her blunt courage, but generally apolitical or you're just not interested and almost could have been a heroine on the other side. She was born over here. And it was fascinating to dig down a little bit. And one of the resources I found was an archive of someone who had some letters that she had written later on after the war, which show a very different perspective on her character. So she was deeply anti-Semitic. She never, after the war, ever reevaluated her loyalties or looked at the regime or criticised it. And it was very interesting to see that she was absolutely in denial. She chose willingly to look the other way. And That balance hadn't been given to her story, so I was interested in that.
This is the woman who, days before Hitler dies, flies into Berlin, doesn't she, to try and rescue him.
This is one of the most famous stories about her, and it's an incredible story. So she was brought in by Robert Ritter von Grimm, who she was a very close friends with, and Hitler had asked him to come into Berlin when it was surrounded by the Red Army to receive last orders. And he knew that one of the craft to take them in from an outside airport right into central Berlin, the best thing to use would be an early helicopter. And Hannah was the first woman to fly a helicopter, first person actually to fly a helicopter inside a building, yeah. Quite extraordinary. So he brought her in to help. When they got to the airfield, the helicopter had been destroyed anyhow. So he was going to leave her and fly in on his own, but she wormed her way into the fuselage without telling him and came in to a closer airport. And then they stopped and they're going to have to do the last hop. So they got to the next airport and they only had a small plane. So they flew in a Fizzler Storch, which is really a reconnaissance plane. And she was behind him, behind his seat. And as they came into Berlin, the Red Army anti-aircraft guns shot up and one of the bullets went through the nose of the plane and also went into Richard von Grimm's legs. He slumped unconscious from blood loss and Hannah had to lean over his shoulders to land this aircraft, the story is, on the main east-west axis in Berlin.
It's in front of the Brandenburg Gate, isn't it?
It is. The wreck was there and the photographs of it, you know, later when the Americans have got this plane there, you can see it. And she dragged him out of the aircraft and got him to the bunker and he was treated by Hitler's surgeon, Stumpfegger. And you know, Hitler greeted them saying, there's some loyalty in the world and gave her a present, which was a cyanide tablet. And so they spent a couple of days there and left. She begged him, apparently, to come out with her. And he refused. And she flew out with Richard von Grimm, taking last orders and various other things out, including Eva Braun's last letter, which she read. She shouldn't have read it, but she was very dismissive about it. She didn't really rate Eva Braun and she threw it out the window. So we don't have that.
But you didn't just tell her story. You did an amazing thing. You found, I think, someone who really was the absolute opposite.
Much said I don't want to tell just the story of heroines, I didn't want to just tell Hannah's story. This is not about glorifying in any way. I wanted to put it in context and balance. And I was fortunate enough to come across the story of another woman whose story was pretty much unknown over here. Her name was Melita Schiller. And she and Hannah actually learnt to glide over the same green slopes in there.
They were slightly different ages, weren't they?
Yeah, Melita was 9 years older. So they had very different perspectives as well. Melita was informed by the First World War and Hannah was informed by, you know, rising.
Growing up in Nazi Germany.
Yeah. In some senses, they're very similar. They were both great patriots. They both had a strong sense of courage and duty. And they were both brilliant, brilliant pilots. So brilliant that the Nazi regime, who really saw this as a very male field, needed them, didn't just want them, but needed them to do this test work. And Melita also was an aeronautical engineer and absolutely brilliant. And so her role was developing the Stuka dive bombers. And she not only developed them herself, she developed things like the bomb sites, but she also then went into the field and did the test work in them. So testing dive bombs in prototype machines.
Thousands and thousands of tests.
Yeah, over 2,000 during the course of the war. You know, a lot of people died in the test program. So a man doing a test dive, he did more than one, was considered, you know, heroic, really. Melita would do up to 15 a day. Extraordinary work. No one else could do it. Nazis being Nazis looked for a biological explanation. They started wondering if women's blood content was different or something. They had to justify it in those terms. But she justified it another way. The reason she was doing it was because, we don't know exactly when, but possibly in 1935, when the Nuremberg Laws came in, which enshrined racial discrimination in German law, she found out that her father's father had been born Jewish and she was considered Mischling. That's half their Jewish, term, yeah. Half-blood, yeah. And so she applied for equal to Aryan status, not just for herself. In fact, she was granted it herself, but she refused it. She said she'd only take it if it was for all of her family. And so she knew that she had to make herself uniquely valuable to the regime for them to consider this. Very few people were given this status. So she was saving her family. But that wasn't enough for her.
No. People would probably have more of an idea of her if you mention her married name.
Yes. So Melita married into an old German family. She loved her husband, but I'm sure that marrying into that family was partly as well about trying to Germanify her. And it was useful for him as well. She married a man called Alexander von Stauffenberg, and he was the elder brother of Klaus von Stauffenberg, who is famous, of course, for the Valkyrie bomb plot and proposed coup afterwards. Probably the most famous attempt on Hitler's life. Sadly, of course, not successful. So she was very close to Klaus. And one of the wonderful things when you look at some of these women's stories is that there are new sources that haven't been looked at. People haven't looked with those eyes and they haven't researched around them so much. And so even on something as famous as the bomb plot, we managed to find new resources. One of the things that I found, I got in touch with Melita's family, who very kindly opened up their drawers and so on, is her 1943-1944 handwritten diary. It's an incredible resource. And it actually, you know, we've got entries for the 20th of July, 1944. Yes. And what we found was that Melita was very close to Klaus. She had been providing a safe place for him to meet people involved in the plot. Because she was a pilot, she had access to use a yacht on the Wannsee Lake in Berlin. And nobody could bug them there. So it was a very safe place for conversation. Yeah. So there was a lot of them going sailing increasingly as we run up towards July. And then in the weeks and the days beforehand, she's increasingly staying over in his Tristanstrasse flat, which is basically conspirators HQ. She's there actually just two nights before the plot. And we found out that she had offered to fly Klaus to the assassination attempt at the Volslayer and bring him back again. But she couldn't get the right plane on the day. And so that didn't happen. But she was very involved in the conspiracy.
You couldn't have found two women more opposite ends of the spectrum, could you?
Both pilots, both patriots, but with a very different sense of what that patriotism meant. Mm. One of them's a fanatical Nazi. The other one supports the old sort of Junker values, a different, the Germany of Schiller. And one of them tries to save Hitler. The other one is involved in the most famous attempt on his life. And yet these women knew each other throughout the war. The only two women who were pilots socialising at the Berlin Air Club. The only two working from the same airfields. Mm. And yet ended their lives on the opposite sides of history. It's an extraordinary opportunity to look at all sorts of things like the roles that could be available to women in Nazi Germany, the limited choices, gender and technology, all of these things which haven't been looked through that prism before.
The Germans didn't put the women to work, did they? But then you get this other side where...
They're almost honorary men, these two. Melita certainly considers herself an honorary man. One of the ironies is that Hannah, who is the fanatical supporter of the regime, was a bit of a feminist, and she's very critical of the men. Obviously, both of them experienced a huge amount of sexism and resistance to their work. She calls in the big shots and gets to fly whatever she wants. Whereas Melita is not. She's sort of old conservative values. She's not a racist, but she's not a feminist. And the one talk that she gave that we have the manuscript of it, at one point she says, you know, we female pilots are not suffragettes. So it's quite nice that we don't have a goodie who's completely good and a baddie who's, well, I mean, she's pretty bad, but they're complex individuals. Mm. This is not a black and white story. It's not about good Nazis or bad women. It's about real women in difficult circumstances, nevertheless making very strong moral choices, and they made different ones, and it's an important story for them.
But I think that's the thing about telling women's stories, because we've had 70-plus years of male-based history, haven't we? And now we're getting to tell these stories of women, and we're getting a different history, aren't we? We're getting a different take on history. And I think that's what's so important. Is that what draws you to writing about women?
Yeah, some of that is. I think especially when you look at even the heroine, like the women in SOE, you tend to see them presented as very courageous and, you know, plucky. And they went in and they did the best job they could and they were very beautiful. And you don't hear so much that they went in, they did the same job as men. They were trained the same, armed the same, put in the front line or behind enemy lines alongside the men. They were put in for a slightly different job, mainly to be couriers, which men did as well. But several of them ended up, like Pearl Witherington or Nancy Wake, leading armies of men, both French and deputy officers underneath them who were men. And so really, they were leading armies. You know, and these stories haven't been told. What hasn't been told is that these women were really effective and they made a very significant contribution to the war effort, not just that they tried hard and were plucky. So it's good to be able to restore the balance on the effectiveness of the female special agents. There are other stories that are told, but we're still missing quite a lot. You know, it was very interesting. Recently, the RAF become the first part of the British military to open all jobs to female applicants. The last job that will be opened up that has made that piece of history is women in combat roles with the RAF, but on the ground in combat roles supporting the bases. And of course, there was a huge furore about it because women aren't as strong and it will lead to this, that and the other. But if women aren't as strong, they still have to pass the same fitness test. Exactly. If you pass that fitness test, male or female, you are presumably fit for the job and so on. So there doesn't need to be a gender discrimination. That's still happening today. And if you look at the lens through which we've looked at women's history, you hardly know that women were actually in combat roles. In the Second World War, they were out there doing the same work. So yes, it is important these stories are retold and they still have huge contemporary relevance.